I know you're tired. I know I'm the last speaker, and that you've been so good that I was. I hope you can do one more. Okay. So my first reading of 100 Years of Solitude took place 3 years after the book came out in Spanish. So the book comes out in Spanish in 67. In 1970, it was the summer of 1970, and I was 21 years old, and a recent college graduate who could not get enough of Latin American contemporary literature. I had accepted my first job as a high school French-Spanish teacher at a suburban North Jersey high school, and had decided to continue my studies by attending Middlebury College's summer program in Vermont. It was there that I was introduced to 100 Years of Solitude. The course, Contemporary Fiction of Latin America, was taught by a brilliant Colombian professor by the name of Eduardo Camacho. He featured, and the course itself featured all books by that were part of the Latin American literary boom. Our reading list included the novels of Julio Cortázar, Guillermo Cabrera Infante, and Juan Rulfo. These were long novels that featured discontinuity and fragmentation, and novels that demanded an active reader. And towering above them all was García Márquez's 100 Years of Solitude. Professor Camacho devoted several lectures to García Márquez's masterpiece, leading his class through a journey that forever cemented my interest in Latin American literature. 100 Years of Solitude, Professor Camacho told us, was many books contained in one. And he was right. In my first reading of this text, I found a strange reinvention of the Bible, complete with a version of creation and apocalypse. I also discovered that García Márquez's book could be appreciated as a metaphor of not only Colombian history, but also a metaphor for Latin American history. The book contained references to Latin American colonial history, but it also had references to neocolonial times as foreign capitals, such as the United Fruit Company, invaded the continent in the mid-20th century. Thus, it was through my first awareness of the multiple readings that this book could suggest that I realized that my initial encounter with 100 Years of Solitude would be the first of many throughout my life as a college professor. In fact, as we have witnessed in this gathering, the existing critical bibliography of 100 Years of Solitude is so plentiful that it would probably spill out of this room. Influential critical readings for me were the essay by writer Carlos Fuentes, who was also a member of the boom generation, and the article was called García Márquez, A Second Reading. Was published in 69. And this article examined the role of myth in the novel. And a second article that came out much later, 100 Years of Solitude, the Novel as Myth and Archive, was published in 84 by literary critic Roberto González Echevarría. Although written from very different perspectives, both studies identify the tension in the book between historical and mythical time as central to the understanding of 100 Years of Solitude. These two articles opened up crucial dimensions that allowed me a window from which to teach this book to my students at Holy Cross. And as the years passed and the bibliography of 100 Years of Solitude grew, there were many other readings that colored mine, such as Jean Bell Villada's and Raymond Williams' books on García Márquez, and as you can appreciate yourselves last night, the recent book of Ilan Stavins. To all of them, I owe this presentation. Today, I hope to draw attention to the manner in which García Márquez's novel produces its own readers and writers, and how the presence of such entities inside the text lead us to the outside readers, ourselves, to an understanding of the author's ideas on language and how it affects our view of the world. García Márquez was quite aware of the fact that words can create beautiful things, and yet he was also aware that words can be held accountable for much destruction. In 100 Years of Solitude, we find a commentary, always implicit, that reveals how our vision of the world depends on language and how our human identity is defined through language. And let us just backtrack a little bit. Why is García Márquez interested in the implications and on the role of language in our lives? The genre of the novel, since its very early days with Cervantes and Lawrence Stern, had been a self-reflexive genre, meaning that these early texts included within them the story of how they were written and allowed the reader to meditate on the fact that he or she was not only reading a story, but also reading about how the story was constructed. This artistic interest by writers to show how their novels were constructed from within became quite popular during European modernism and postmodernism, which in the case of Latin American literature corresponds roughly to the period that begins with the creative works of Borges in the 50s and extends to the authors of the boom and the post-boom in the 60s and the 70s. García Márquez's book needs to be situated within this context, that is, the period that includes both modernism and postmodernism, in order to be fully understood. From the moderns, such as Faulkner, Hemingway, and Virginia Woolf, but also from Borges, García Márquez inherits this interest in creating stories which are conscious of their own identity as books, that we call metafiction in our field. And from the postmoderns, García Márquez continues this interest, but he also inherits a deep distrust for the language of official history, which includes also factual language of journalism. In 100 Years of Solitude, García Márquez is concerned with the act of making meaning through language, its scope, its limits, its necessity, and finally, its frustrations. The late critic Naomi Shore indicates that inside a text there can be characters, and this is not in relation to 100 Years, but in relation to the books of modernism and postmodernism. I quote, that inside a text there can be characters that she called interpretants. These are readers and writers who can assume various roles. At times, these interior readers can be either creative, as they fill in gaps of meaning, but they can also be destructive by failing at the act of interpretation, either by misinterpreting or by being reluctant to assume the role of interpretation. These interpretants go much further than offering us a mirror image of the outside reader, as ourselves, and press us instead with an array of interpretive possibilities. Most importantly, the ultimate effect of these readers and writers is to make the reader, the outside reader, question his or her own models of judgment. The story of the Buendias, as we all know, is narrated in the language of myth, and in a sense, it is this language of myth that offers a critique of the language of official history. This critique occurs inside the text through characters who are involved in activities that relate to language. We have writers such as Melquiades, and we also have readers, several members of the Buendía family, who are translators who attempt to translate the written manuscripts. In the book, we find readers who are distracted and refuse to read or interpret the manuscript with any consistency, such as the twins José Arcadio II and Aureliano II. But we also have at the end of the tale a very attentive reader named Aureliano Babilonia, who was the last of the Buendías. My examination of the role of language in the novel begins with a discussion of the essence of language in the episode of the Insomnia Plague, and then it will jump to the distortion of language with the episode of the Banana Strike, and then we will conclude with chapter 20, the last episode of the text, where the language of literature offers a possible understanding of the story of the Buendías. The plague episode has been the subject of many critical studies about language and identity. It confronts memory and forgetfulness. It also isolates words and presents us with the absence of words. The context in which it occurs, the plague, the insomnia plague, I should say. Remember that it was during the first years of the foundation of Macondo. The village is growing, and joining the family is Rebecca, the orphan girl who arrives mysteriously. And it is Rebecca who introduces the symptoms of the plague. She's afflicted with an insomnia that also causes memory loss. Eventually, the entire town becomes infected with insomnia and the associated amnesia. And to facilitate memory, the inhabitants of the town begin to label everything. So what we see here is that he presents the plague and links it to identity, right? The notion, they begin to erase the notion of things, and finally the identity of the people and the awareness of being. So there's a link here that Garcia Marquez wants to make between language, the essence of language, and an identity. He alerts the reader early on. This is an implicit commentary that he's making. But here, before this, of course, we had the beginning of the book and the biblical allusions of the world was so recent that many things lacked names. So there was a whole attention of the reader to the act of naming, and now to the fact that language is linked to who we are. There's a second, this is long, but yes, thank you.
Seeking a cure. When his father told him about his alarm at having forgotten even the most impressive happenings of his childhood, Aureliano explained his method to him, and Jose Arcadio Buendia put it into practice all through the house, and later on imposed it on the whole village. With an inked brush, he marked everything with its name: table, chair, clock, door, wall, bed, pan. He went to the corral and marked the animals and plants: cow, goat, pig, hen, cassava, caladium, banana. Little by little, studying the infinite possibilities of a loss of memory, he realized that the day might come when things would be recognized by their inscriptions, but that no one would remember their use. Then he was more explicit. The sign that he hung on the neck of a cow was an exemplary proof of the way in which the inhabitants of Macondo were prepared to fight against loss of memory. This is the cow. She must be milked every morning so that she will produce milk, and the milk must be boiled in order to be mixed with coffee to make coffee and milk. Thus, they went on living in a reality that was slipping away, momentarily captured by words, by which would escape irremediably when they forgot the values of the written letters.
Thank you. How arbitrary is the nature of language, is what Garcia Marquez seems to be questioning here. Why is it important to the author? Some critics have interpreted this episode as Macondo's transformation of consciousness, a mark on the beginning of recorded history, that is, the beginning of written language. Some other critics have talked about Macondo's initial loss of mythical memory, of the innocence associated with creation. Some have said that the plague represents the silenced discourse of the poor and marginalized forced to lose their identity. And I think it's all of the above. It is all of the above. But it is evident that Garcia Marquez wants us to meditate on the issue of what is language and how does it capture reality, the whole aesthetic issue, the issue that a writer is always confronted with. His tool is language. Reality must be captured by it. So the insomnia plague is only cured unexpectedly when Melquiades, the gypsy, returns to town bearing an antidote, which slowly restores the memory of the patriarch. But we must also remember that Melquiades brought a new invention, another one, which could also capture reality, and that was the daguerreotype, that provided an alternative, a visual way to capture reality. And that comes in very close to the cure. So once again, it is important to recall that The insomnia plague is also a reflection of García Márquez's modernistic times, a time where other people, other artists, were reflecting on the possibility of language. And this dialogue really is most evident in the visual work of artists such as René Magritte, for instance, who lived between 1898 and 1967. Magritte deeply meditated on language and perception years before it became a subject of literary criticism and also of writing. And I think we should see this for one second, okay? René Magritte in 1929 had a series of images and by the title of The Treasury of Images. And this one in particular relates to our discussion as it provides a visual link to the episode of the plague. This is not a pipe, right? Ceci n'est pas un pipe. So Magritte gives us an image of a pipe, and it tells you that it's not, it tells us that it's not a pipe, right? He wants to really bring the attention to the relationship between word and image, not in an unlike manner of what García Márquez was doing when the inhabitants were labeling things. What has more authority? What is stronger, the image or the representation of the image? According to Magritte, really both the image of the pipe and the label of the pipe were only approximations. They were not the pipe. And that was basically what he was asking or trying to do with his visual work, meaning he was bringing to his audience an element of doubt and skepticism about the possibilities of language, which I think is clearly in our book, 100 Years of Solitude. Much later in 1966, Magritte returned to this topic with double the two mysteries, okay? And he expands his critique. We're not going to get into Magritte, but he expands his critique of language and again questions the possibilities of the written word. So his modern and postmodern interest in language, in doubting language's authority, it has a connection. This is 1966. García Márquez is writing 100 Years of Solitude. I have no idea if García Márquez was acquainted with Magritte, but it's certainly something I plan to research at some point. Another thing I find that is interesting and a link between the two is that much like García Márquez and his style of magical realism, Magritte maintained a realistic quality to these images. He was a surrealist, but he was told that he was too realistic. He wasn't like his peers. So that he uses his images, his realistic images, as a platform from which to understand perception and meditate on perception and language. So, we will move away from Magritte right now. But just to get you involved in thinking that García Márquez has an interest in us meditating on the essence of language with his beginning chapters, and then as it goes, as the book progresses, the massacre, not the massacre itself, but what happens after the massacre, is another commentary on language and on the distortion of language, how language, written language, can be distorted. They are in the plaza. The workers are in the plaza, and they've been told to gather there. And of course, what happens is eventually the military shoots them down in the book. I'm not talking about the historical exact moment, I'm just talking about what happens in the book. Just to do a little bit of background on this, José Arcadio Segundo has been organizing, and just to repeat a little bit from this morning, but I'm totally within the fiction while this morning we were outside the fiction in history, right? So we're now looking at the book from the inside and how Garcia Marquez worked with this. He has José Arcadio II organizing the banana plantation workers to strike in protest of inhumane working conditions. Macondo is placed under martial law, and the workers respond by sabotaging the plantation. The government then invites more than 3,000 people to gather for a meeting in the plaza, and the meeting happens to be a trick, and the army surrounds the workers with machine guns and systematically massacres them. Here, to me, the image of the dragon's tail is quite important. It just denotes the whole idea of the movement of the tail, the movement of the masses, the movement of the crowd, and how the confusion that was going on at that time. And that's, I just wanted you guys to think of it before we talk about the denial of that this happened, right? This one I will read just, but I will ask more from you. This continues, this is the description of the crowd. They were penned in, swirling about in a gigantic whirlwind that little by little was being reduced to its epicenter at the edges, as the edges were systematically being cut off around like an onion being peeled by the insatiable and methodical shears of the machine guns. Again, here we have another image that gives you the idea of the helplessness of the crowd. You have the layers of people being gunned down. Anything else that you see there that you want to bring into this, into the language of Garcia Marquez? Yeah, what about it? Exactly. Using those words, you can sense the confusion. Yes. And exactly. Very good. Very good. So we might not just read this. I'm just going to leave it in up there for you to look at. Remember, after the massacre, José Arcadio II gets into it. You know, he thinks he's riding with life people, but he's really in a train of death. He wakes up and he realizes that the people next to him are dead people. And this is a very visual description of what's happening. You could just see, it could be filmed, even though Garcia Marquez forbids anyone to film this book, but because he wants us to have our own idea. And I can see in a slide like this, in a passage like this, how the flashes of light, he's seeing the people next to him. First it's dark, he thinks that they're alive. He feels comfortable. The author sort of leads us on that he thought, you know, he made himself comfortable on the side that pained him less. And all of a sudden, he sees that through the light, as the train progresses, he sees that they are corpses, women corpses, child corpses, that would be thrown into the sea like rejected bananas. The dehumanization of the people. Very strong and surprising for the very first time you read this book, this shocks everyone. So Garcia Marquez makes us feel the massacre before he then works with language to deny the reality of it. Okay, and that's where I wanted to get to you. So José Arcadio manages to jump off this train and walks back to Macondo, and there he is horrified to discover that all memory of the massacre has been wiped out. So here we have that repetition. There are no, you know, they talk about magical realism. This book has some magical realism in many scenes, but in a scene like this, it's really the journalist in Garcia Marquez takes over. And this is a very direct language. He has no images. It's so hard to depict what's happened. And notice the repetition of nothing. Nothing has ever happened, and nothing will ever happen. So there is a stress, but that doesn't come from image. It comes from the strength of the words. And also this last word, this is a happy town. In that way, they were able to wipe out the union leaders. There is right here a distortion, right, that the idea of reality can be created. A new reality can be created by language. In this chapter, which I don't have time to go into, but this chapter, as Ilan was saying, every chapter is sort of a unit in itself. And this one is very interesting because the whole topic about the distortion of language is also illustrated with the character of Fernanda. Fernanda is your very rigid bourgeois, member of the bourgeoisie who just was so interested in appearances, and she just wanted things to look in a certain way. And when they bring the baby, who's going to be the last of the Aurelianos, to her, a nun brings a baby to the house, and she's really aghast to have a baby that's a member of the family just brought in like that. So she says to the nun, and I'll just quote this. The nun brings the baby to her, and she says to the nun, Fernanda, "We'll tell them we found him floating in the basket," Fernanda said, smiling. The nun says, "No one will believe it." But Fernanda says, "If they believe in the Bible," Fernanda replied, "I don't see why they shouldn't believe it from me." So here, García Márquez is really creating the same theme. He's really illustrating the theme of the distortion of language through two very separate episodes. In Nature, you know, this is a, you know, the official language and the distortion of history, and also in As Hypocrisy, language, people that just create their own reality and refuse to see things. Okay, so we go to the last chapter, the final segment, and I just have a couple of passages there that develop another dimension of the theme of language in the novel, which is the function of language as literature. As you might remember, these are the last pages. In the last pages of the book, you know, Gaston, Amaranta Ursula's husband, travels to Belgium to follow up on his business plans. And when he learns that his wife has an affair with her nephew, he doesn't return. And one by one, this is the end, the decline of Macondo, right? One by one, first the Catalonian bookseller, and then Aureliano Babilonia's four friends leave Macondo. So Macondo is now a town abandoned in silence. So what happens? Amaranta gives birth to a baby that has the tail of a pig. She soon dies after giving birth, and Aureliano becomes so distraught, he leaves the house. He begins to walk around Macondo and forgets about the baby. He seeks comfort in the arms of Nigromanta, by the way. And when he comes back, the baby has died, and there's ants feeding on the corpse. So all of a sudden, Aureliano turns to the manuscripts. He turns to the manuscripts, which are still found in that magical room where time doesn't pass. And like his ancestors had tried before, he begins to try to read and decipher the documents. As he reads, he realizes that the line of the Buendias has come to an end. Moreover, as he reads, he finds that the text describes in that very moment his act of reading as he reads. Thus, he becomes aware that his own story is contained in the documents. Absolutely. So here we have, you know, the prophecy, the biblical tone returns, the whole mythical air of the novel returns again. We have had a fluctuation of a mythical tone and then a historical journalistic tone. And here now, as we come to the end, the prophecy is fulfilled. So to me, this is like the most dramatic part. I mean, I know the last paragraph is everybody's paragraph, but when he stands up, right, he he couldn't even wait. He stands up and he begins to read out loud. So you have language, spoken language, right? And not only that, but he's deciphering, he's translating. We were talking here before about the idea of translation as interpretation. Translation is interpretation, and every translator, as Ilan was talking about it, has a different take on certain words, because translation is the interpretation of reality, which is language. How does language capture reality? So here he is reading out loud, and then he sees his end. If Aureliano Babilonia's reading causes the final destruction of Macondo, it is up to the outside reader, ourselves, to learn from the mistakes of that last Buendía. García Márquez's dramatic ending forces the outside reader to acknowledge the creative but also the destructive potential of language. The failures of the first Aurelianos to get at the meaning of the manuscripts are sometimes lessons on how not to read or interpret. In doing so, García Márquez asks us as readers to be aware of the power of interpretation, and also to understand that the creation and destruction of Macondo have been entirely created by our own act of reading. The Buendía story is one of deterministic failure, yet the hope we find in this book, and the reason it sold so many copies is not because it's a deterministic failure, it's because it's a hopeful book. It's outside, it's for us, the outside readers, as we can learn from the mistakes of those distracted readers inside the text. So as a third function of language here, the power of language is in literature. And that's, so the importance of the act of interpretation, which in 100 years of solitude became the activity of deciphering the message of the manuscripts, is again present, and the concept is amplified in García Márquez's noble address of 1982. Here García Márquez implores his audience, which he addresses as vulnerable old Europe, to understand the reality of Latin America in a different way. And we're not going to read this, but I'm going to read, these are lines from his lecture, The Solitude of Latin America. But it's very interesting, because it's the second part, he just says to the Europeans, you're not seeing us with your correct, with the eyes that you should see us. You should see yourselves. We are going through what was to you your middle age, you know. So he says it is in the center here. It is only natural that they insist on measuring. These are the Europeans that he's addressing while he's reading this. It is only natural that they insist on measuring us with the yardstick that they use for themselves, forgetting that the ravages of life are not the same for all, and that the quest of our own identity is just as arduous and bloody for us as it was for them. And then at the bottom here, the interpretation of our reality through patterns not of our own serves only to make us ever more unknown, ever less free, ever more solitary. The noble address is important because it relates in a profound way to the author's concerns with the reality captured by language and how that reality is misinterpreted by others. Perhaps I can best conclude this presentation by acknowledging an open question. How useful is the presence of characters who are readers and writers in 100 years of solitude? It is evident that the act of reading, its implications, and the responses of readers, both within and outside the fiction, are issues of social concern for our author. Yet finding readers and writers that strive for an interpretation of language in the works of García Márquez is not surprising. The theme extends to the books the author published after 100 Years of Solitude. Chronicle of a Death Foretold is a critique of the language of journalism. If you've read that text, it's all about how events get reported. The General and His Labyrinth this is the story of Bolivar, but García Márquez creates a period of 10 days that wasn't accounted for by historians, and he recreates it. So he's challenging the official story of Bolivar. And in Love in the Time of the Cholera, he praises the language of literature through the letters that the lovers write to one another. But only in 100 Years of Solitude, the author encapsulates all of the above concerns about language, because as it conveys 100 years, a message that is both social and aesthetic. Language for Garcia Marquez is the only means through which human beings can be saved from the stigma of being forgotten and from the dangers of letting others construct their reality. The end.
Can we get the lights again? Thank you. Some questions?
Do you think there's any relation between Garcia Marquez and Melquiades, that he saw himself as a kind of Melquiades chronicling a family?
I think that, Melquiades is the author within the text, so there could be a reflection of a mirror image of the writer within and the author outside the text and the author inside. But knowing Garcia Marquez, I don't think he wants to make those kinds of equations. I mean, Melquiades is this magical figure, and he's not, Garcia Marquez is not. So there is that. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about why he might have chosen the word Babylonia, thinking of all the languages? And
I would think it's that biblical, to follow the biblical theme that he had, the apocalypse and Babylon, the city destroyed by sin. So I think, what happens is, and I tell my students, don't think of this book as an allegory of anything that is going to carry through. The Bible figures in this book as a structure that helps Garcia Marquez construct the tale, but it's not an allegory of he throws in Babylonia, he throws in the plagues and the diluvios, the deluge, but all of it, and then he takes them away. He gives you a little, and you think you have it, and then he takes it away. And you just have to work within that tension of the book. It's history, but it's myth. Even when he talks about literature, at the end, he sort of degrades literature when they put it in the train, in the back, in one of the... So he praises literature, but he degrades it at the same time, and it's that tension that the book is built upon.
Thank you again.